From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a city street when a man riding a bicycle stopped to make a point. He was proudly riding his bicycle to work, and he saw something that enraged him. It was another human being driving a car. Car of all things. The man on the bike offered his middle finger as a way to express his feelings about car-dominated cities. He's an urbanist, and he's going to let everyone know. All right, this kind of seems extreme and a little farcical, but this hour we're going to have a conversation about whether urbanists have become too mean, too rude, too condescending, too smug. It's not just a conversation about basic decorum. It's about what works and what doesn't in convincing people to change their habits. This idea fell into my lap on Twitter when an urbanist in Vancouver named Phil Karras tweeted the following, quote, "Random observation. When I started planning school, it felt like urbanism was about encouraging folks to live more sustainably and building our cities to facilitate that. Lately, a lot of urbanism seems to be about shaming people for living different lifestyles than us." End quote. Is Phil right? Have urbanists become too smug? Or is it time to start shaming people who won't change their habits? My guests this hour include on the phone with us, Phil Karras is a senior planner with TransLink, which is the public transit agency for Metro Vancouver. Nice to take the time for us. Thank you, Phil.
Hi, Evan. Glad to be on. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is David Riley. He's an urbanist and former newspaper reporter here in Rochester. David, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Marlena Zink works for a local engineering firm with a background in planning. Marlena, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Jason Partika is a member of Reconnect Rochester. He's chair of the Bus Innovation Work Group. Jason, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks.
All right. We've got a lot to work through already, but I want to start with Phil because you're the spark that started this fire. What was it that kind of caused you to make that observation to begin with, Phil? What were you seeing specifically that bugged you?
Yeah, I guess maybe it's just a matter of me being too deep in Twitter these days. But
That's everybody, man.
Yeah. I think it's just a bit of an issue of maybe just tone. But, I keep seeing common refrains like ban cars. And, you know, it's become this sort of war between teams almost. Urbanism has become a team sport. There's pro-car versus anti-car. There's NIMBYs versus so-called YIMBYs. And it just seems like it's becoming this matter of there's got to be winners and losers, good guys and bad guys. And I feel like when I was getting interested in urban planning, to me it was more about, okay, how do we work within the system we have and adapt things to suit our needs better, to provide more sustainable lifestyle choices and to help facilitate people who want those lifestyles but can't either afford them now or can't engage in them because of other reasons.
Yeah, fair enough. And we're going to hear from our listeners as we go throughout this hour. I know Tim in Pittsford is going to call because Tim in Pittsford is always saying he's tired of being shamed for driving a car to the city of Rochester. And he's going to get on board with what Phil is saying. I want to ask our guests in studio if they agree. David Riley, do you agree?
To some extent, I see some of what Phil is talking about. And I'm hedging a little bit because, like him, I'm not sure to what extent that's representative of urbanists in general and to what extent it's representative of Twitter, which I think tends to devolve into rude and condescending remarks, whatever the topic might be.
Snark.
Yeah.
It's just snark right. In trade. So fair enough. But you think at least it's a legitimate question to raise for urbanists?
Sure. And a legitimate question about whether that's an effective way to go about making your case for a more urban lifestyle or for more urban style development.
Okay. Marlena?
I think the whole culture of shaming in general is unproductive at best. And the way I see it is that in education and planning, or even being really deep in urbanism and that culture, is it's a privilege to have that kind of education. And I think even though this kind of phrasing has become a little cliche, but with that kind of privilege comes a responsibility. And I think when it turns into shaming, it becomes elitist and counterproductive because you're not using your education to teach others and help others. You're using it to berate people.
Okay. And Jason Partika, I'm going to kick to you by reading what you wrote in the Twitter thread that started this whole thing. You're going to have to come on and defend this. Are you ready for this? Here we go.
Absolutely.
Jason wrote, quote, "When we ban cigarette smoking in public because of its impact on the environment and public health, are we shaming smokers? Maybe. Pollution created by cars pumps toxic gases into the air and warms the environment, the same 1-2 punch as smoking. Are we shaming drivers? Maybe. I understand why people move to the suburbs. They're trying to do what's best for their children. They want a big yard for the kids to play in and good schools for the kids to go to. Nobody moves to the suburbs to destroy the world, but the consequences are the same regardless," end quote. All right, were you being hyperbolic for effect, or you think suburbanites are destroying the world?
Well, I don't think the intention is for them to destroy the world, but, you know, there's urbanism itself has gotten caught up in two larger things, the climate change crisis and then just the structural institutions of like racism and poverty in our society. And urbanism is being seen as a solution to both of those things, even though urbanism was created independent of those. So I think people cling on to that, you know, how we transport ourselves is, you know, either in the top three contributors to climate change, and we need to radically change how we transport ourselves in order to undo the effects of climate change. And it, you know, it's always frustrating, you know, change is slow. And I think people can get frustrated when they think there's a solution in hand and it's just not being implemented.
Do you think shaming works?
I don't think so. I think, it's something that's been going on for 20 years. It's not like climate change is new. People have been told to drive less for 20 years. We're not driving less. So it obviously doesn't work. If it did, we wouldn't see that trend.
Okay. And so this is a time where I'm going to turn back to Phil Karras and offer some insight that we got on the program recently from Tom Nichols, who is a professor at the Naval War College and wrote a book called The Death of Expertise. And I asked him about the difference between sort of slow, considerate, rational conversation versus shaming. And Nichols said he's basically to the point where he thinks shaming is actually more effective. He said he's tired of ignorance and bad decision making and bad arguments. And he's tired of just saying, oh, you think the moon landing was faked? Well, let's unpack your belief there. He's saying, no, I'm going to mock you for that because that's idiotic. And, so Phil Karras, from the Tom Nichols standpoint, that mocking and shaming actually works better than careful engagement. Is this a place where you would disagree with that?
Well, I have to say my worldview is actually a little shattered hearing Tom say that, because so much of my motivation in bringing up this topic was based on that idea of experts versus lay people, and the death of expertise. To go back to what Jason said, I would say his tweet response is something I agree with 100%. And it's a matter of telling people, I don't think we should sugarcoat the fact that suburban car-dependent development is killing the environment. I don't think we should sugarcoat it, but it's a matter of telling people, providing people, saying there are options, there are things we can do, approaching it rationally, and not, again, like Jason said, people don't move to the suburbs because they're trying to kill the environment. A lot of people, I do believe, are still somewhat ignorant about the effects of their lifestyle choices on the overall environment. You might think of things like, oh, I recycle plastic bags, or, I use an organics bin, think you're helping the environment without even realizing that you drive to work an hour every day and you're pumping emissions into the atmosphere. So in that case, I don't know what to say about whether or not shaming is effective. I think being blunt is more effective than beating around the bush, but there's a fine line between being blunt and shaming.
Okay, I think that's fair. And David Riley also made an interesting comment before this program that I want to touch on, because Phil is raising a point that I often make here and in other venues, that you often meet someone who says, well, I drive a Prius. Like, therefore, I've washed my hands of my responsibility to this planet because I drive a Prius. And it obviously goes much deeper than that, and it's going to require a lot more than that. And Phil is talking about, and Jason's talking about, how do we change individual habits? But David, you kind of contrasted that with, while that being valuable, policy is also a goal to change. How do you view the contrast and what urbanists should be focused on?
I guess one of the pitfalls of shaming, other than it, I just generally think it's not a productive way to convince people of much, is that I think it sort of conflates I think it's blaming people for personal decisions, and certainly we all have personal responsibility and can try to make ethical decisions about our lifestyles and how we're impacting the planet. But I think we also have to recognize that people are responding to really systemic incentives and systems that favor development that is fundamentally not urban, that we have for generations had funding priorities and public policies that favor highways and suburban style development over urban style development. So I think to make a dent in that, yeah, certainly the personal decisions are part of that, and it's important to try to win people to our side. But I think part of that is also convincing people so that we can make the case that policies need to change in order to better support urban lifestyles, to make it more feasible and easier for more people to live that way.
Phil, you're with the Public Transit Agency for Metro Vancouver. Do you agree with what you just heard?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. And I think it's something that, not that I want to speak on behalf of my agency, but I think it's something that we strive to do is not only provide sustainable transportation choices, but make people aware of little changes they can make in their daily habits. So, maybe you bike to work one day a week where you don't need to, carry so many things, or walk your child to school rather than driving one day a week. Take incremental steps toward shifting toward a more sustainable lifestyle. Get people more comfortable with transit and biking and walking, and sort of win them over, get them to become advocates on our behalf and start to affect those policy changes that David was talking about.
I want to turn back to Marlena, though, because I got a note on Twitter from a listener named Joe that I want to read here, because Marlena was particularly hard on the idea of shaming or mocking. And I want to frame this in a certain way, because I think to some degree urbanism still is coming from a place of relative privilege, just as the same way that I think dealing with climate change on a personal level is coming from a place of privilege. If you're living in poverty, you don't know how to get your kids to school or where the next meal is going to come from, I'm not going to put any weight on you to help deal with climate change. I mean, you're talking about survival. And urbanism has a sort of a similar place in privilege, though maybe that's debatable and we could talk about that. But it's not just it's not just telling elite educated urbanists not to shame people who might not be elite or educated. Joe on Twitter says, no, this is about shaming elite educated people who should know better and are making dumb choices. Mm-hmm. So Joe writes the following. He says, I shame people all the time. Look at the reaction to the road diet for Lake Avenue. People are losing their minds over slowing down a road that is a known problem and has an actual body count. If you can't handle changes to make a neighborhood more livable for people that live there because you feel entitled to speed through, maybe you are being selfish and deserve shaming. Besides that, I try not to be hostile, but Rochester seems to have a very anti-urban undercurrent. That comes from Joe. What would you say to Joe?
I would say that I do agree that there are people who know better and that have had the opportunity to have an education that teaches them what's good for the collective might not be convenient to their lifestyle. But at the same time, I mean, I just see the individual blame as misplaced, because these are really systemic issues, like we mentioned earlier. And just when it comes to putting all the blame on an individual, I mean, everybody, when it comes down to it, we all can't be a martyr for every cause. And just because us urbanists think urbanism is very important, I think the burden needs to go on people who can be leaders, rather than expecting every person to take the time out of their day to, you know, change their lifestyle. Really, we need to take leadership when we have this relative power and education to afford the average person to adapt their lifestyle. So, you know, making it easier for people to be urbanists rather than complaining when it's inconvenient and, you know, expecting them to change their lives.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Have you changed your own habits as you think more about these issues? Do you consider yourself an urbanist? When you hear the term urbanist, what comes to mind for you? Is it a positive notion? 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're going to get to some of the stuff that's been poking at my brain since Phil was ripping on people who don't like golf courses. We're going to get there. But before we get there, I want to hit one more point on the notion of the impact of shaming and mockery. And I'm actually thinking of an article written by Barry Weiss in the New York Times about so-called Trump voters. Barry Weiss was arguing that by shaming and mocking Trump voters, we are, or people who are sort of on the fence or, you know, like certain things about the president, that you're more likely to entrench them as Trump supporters in 2020. And that piece that Barry Weiss wrote engendered a lot of mockery from people saying, oh, so, you know, we're all so fragile that if we do something that's bad, but somebody tells us it's bad, then we're just going to decide to keep doing it and do it even more. That's silly. And a lot of people were pushing back. But I think some of what I'm hearing from the panel just talks about human psychology, that if people are mocked and pushed around and condescended to, that they may, in fact, entrench that and not really be open to changing. And Marlena, where are you on that?
I completely agree. And I also think when it comes to urbanism, there's some relationship building that we have to do with existing urban communities who we've sort of put down in the past for not living in the suburbs and not, you know, living in a place with a good school district, or putting down taking the bus and biking because those were options out of necessity. And now that, you know, a more elite educated group is saying, hey, maybe that wasn't so bad, it's hard to go back and tell people, okay, just kidding, it, you know, don't go to the suburbs, like stay in the city. And I think that it's also important to go to those groups and maybe listen and draw on their wisdom, in addition to, you know, just drawing on expert knowledge. Like, we've pushed away people and we need to build those connections again.
Okay. And I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you're on the line, we'll come to you in a second. Let's get everyone's thoughts on this. Jason, you probably didn't come out of the womb an urbanist. What changed you growing up?
I think, believe it or not, I actually grew up on a dairy farm south of Buffalo, New York. So I moved to Rochester to go to school here, and I really just appreciated the closeness of everything and the convenience of everything. For me, urbanism, it was just a lifestyle choice. I always use, idealize, like, say, Paris in the movies. You know, people leave work, they stop at the store and get their hunk of cheese and their briquette, and then they go home and have dinner, and that's it. And I really appreciated the simplicity of that. And so I wanted to live in an environment where I could do that. It's difficult in Rochester because we've kind of oriented ourselves around the car, and spaces are just bigger that way. You know, instead of having buildings right next to each other, you have a building, a parking lot, building, that kind of thing. But I really think that's always been the appeal of urbanism. You can save a lot of money, to be honest, just by walking instead of having a car payment and car insurance, that kind of stuff. You get to know your neighbors better. When I ride the bus, like, I go out to the bus stop the same time every morning. I see the same neighbors every morning. You get those connections with your greater community that you don't get in suburbia, that kind of thing. And that was just always the appeal to me, just the lifestyle of it.
Is there a good baguette in Rochester?
Not a good baguette.
Man, you're tough, man. I'm going to give you a list. I think there is good baguette here. But okay. I take the point. David Riley, what about Barry Weiss's comment? Is there a parallel to the way we mock people and hope that they'll change and instead they can become entrenched?
I'm very hesitant to concede that Barry Weiss made a good point about anything. But I think there's a difference between the kind of shaming we're talking about and pointed criticism of a problematic position or problematic policy. And I don't want to suggest that I think that criticism is bad. I think you can criticize civilly and make your point without necessarily personally attacking someone. So I do agree that the kind of shaming that Weiss is apparently referring to, I didn't read the piece, is counterproductive and tends to make people sort of hunker down and become defensive. But I think you can certainly civilly make a point. Consider, particularly when you're having these arguments on social media, that you're not just talking to one person, that there are potentially many other people looking at your conversation, and consider how you're reflecting on your cause when you are making your point. So, yeah, I do think there is potentially a parallel there, but I don't want to suggest that criticism is not valid.
Okay. And Phil Karras, is it somewhat just a case of resisting the urge to snark, whether it's on Twitter or in person at meetings of urbanists, et cetera, when you have some very foundational beliefs about what is better? I mean, Jason talked about what he thinks is a better way to live and more neighborly, it's more economical, it's better for the planet. Obviously, the feeling is that it is, for lack of a better term, better, but is it important to resist the urge to snark at people who aren't living that way?
Yeah, I think it is important because one of the lines I think we need to draw when we're talking about mocking or snarking is the difference between calling out an openly racist Trump supporter, for instance, versus somebody who just drives to work because they don't have good transit options. That's a very different situation. Some situations, I think, deserve mockery. The situations we're talking about don't necessarily. And I think a lot of the discussion it's a bit of a microcosm of the way our general societal discourse has devolved into a more emotional-based tenor rather than reason. And this, so I'm drawing on Tom Nichols again here, but I think people get entrenched in their teams and they want to win. And so I think it's very difficult to extract your own emotions from something that, and I think urbanism has an extremely logical, reasonable case to be made, but it's hard to extract that from your own emotional feelings.
Sarah on Twitter tells us there's good baguettes at Flower City Bread. Absolutely, among others. Thank you, Sarah. And Tanya says, I'm a suburbanite who became an urbanist as an adult. I'm unapologetic about the lack of parking in my neighborhood, the noise, the diversity. Thank you, Tanya, for that. Let's get some phone calls. Teddy in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Teddy.
Hi, Evan. Can you hear me, by the way? I'm on a headset.
Yeah, it actually sounds surprisingly half decent. Go ahead.
Well, let me get off of it real fast then. What I wanted to say is that I would advocate that centering ideas about how to make a living space more livable, more dignified, and human is an important, if not paramount, responsibility. So I think urbanism is a great idea. But I want to suggest that maybe the issue that we're confronting seems to be similar to the one that you were confronting in your previous show with Ms. Fargas. When you confront a person who's lived in a certain society for a long enough time, they begin to be entangled in their identity. So maybe the persons who are, learning these things regarding urbanism and educating themselves regarding climate and environment are also putting their identities in front of their opinions. And so that might drive one to shame another based on an unwillingness to accept certain things which you've become so attached to subconsciously. And I want to advocate that maybe we need to have discussions in general which allow for recognition of one's own bias in the moment, And I think it's great that you're having conversations regarding this and trying to bring it up. I'm wondering if, the radio is the most productive place. And the question I'd like to end all of this with is, where can one go to engage and discuss subjects like this and even the cultural relationship that we have to the subject with opposing parties?
It's a good question, Teddy. Thank you for that. And the answer, of course, starts with connections, where the community comes to talk every afternoon. But beyond that, I don't know. Let me go around the table, and then we'll go back to Phil in Vancouver. Marlena, what would you say?
I think it's always important to have these conversations with people closest to you, especially people that you might know. For example, I think a good example is women often say, if a man approaches them and says, I want to, be a feminist. How do I do that? Should I, talk to more women about feminist issues? It's like, no, you should really be having these conversations with other men. And I think it's similar with any issue, and same with urbanism. Maybe if you have a friend who refuses to take anything other than their car, maybe just encourage them, you know, to take the bus with you one day, or, you know, start. I think it's great to start with people close to you.
Okay, Jason?
Yeah, I would say, again, with your neighbors and that kind of thing. As far as spaces can go, if I can do a little shameless self-promotion, if you go to reachconnectrochester.org, we have a calendar there, and we have monthly meetings around buses, walking, rail, that kind of thing, if you want to just meet more like-minded people in urbanism, that kind of thing. But beyond that, we always welcome like talking about the challenges, too, of switching between an urbanist lifestyle and a more sprawled out lifestyle. You know, a lot of people, you know, if they have a car payment or if they live in a suburb, it's not like they can wave a magic wand and move into the city. Things like that. We're always discussing the challenges. You know, even if people want to make that decision, how do I get a house in the city? Or how do I enroll in schools? Like that kind of thing.
Well, I'm going to ask David and Phil about a separate part of Teddy's phone call, and I'm reading Joshua's tweet. He writes to us and says, suggested reading for listeners on this topic is James Cooney's Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. And he says, hint, there's not a chapter on shaming. I remember what the late Louis C.K., before he died, said about... He didn't actually die. His career just died. What the late Louis C.K. said about flying on an airplane and finding out that you can get free internet on the airplane, and then 10 seconds later being told, oh, I'm sorry, it's been disabled for this flight, and how angry he was at something he did not know exist, but then he felt entitled to, and that that was something he deserved, and how quickly he turned. And I'm going back to Teddy's call saying, when people feel strongly about something, they can feel really entrenched with it really quickly. I mean, think about somebody who becomes a climate activist, somebody who becomes a Democrat or a Republican or a Green or a Libertarian, when 5 days ago they weren't, but all of a sudden they've got the fervor of someone who's been doing it for years. I think sometimes, David Riley, there is a purity test that we have, that if you're not as woke as me, that you are flawed and to be shamed and called under the carpet, when you might not have been as woke as you are until recently, and that people move at different paces. And I think that I see some parallels here with the urbanism discussion. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you have to try to meet people where they are when you talk to them about these kinds of things. You know, I, as you mentioned at the outset, I'm a former journalist and tried, you know, as a journalist to kind of remain impartial about these things. And it's only really in the last couple of years that I've made the jump into the planning world that I've been or started to feel comfortable to sort of advocate for a particular side. And as Jason was talking about, you know, I also grew up very rurally. I'm not an urbanist from birth. It's something I sort of came to through a lot of the reporting that I did and talking to people advocating for urbanist causes. So I try to keep in mind, you know, I didn't come from this background either. And when I talk to people about it, I try to approach it much in the way I thought about writing stories as a reporter, which is, you know, how would I talk to a friend who asked me about this at a party who is going to be interested in this for about 30 seconds? And how do I hold their interest and explain it in a way that's you know, engaging and kind of back to basics and... recognizes that they may not be familiar with the issue and recognizes that, you know, I may be a little bit more familiar with it, but I'm certainly wary of claiming to be an expert on the subject, and I have a lot to learn as well.
Yeah, to David's point, Phil, about at a party, Jason's talking about neighbors. I like Marlena's point. Think about your own family. If you are an urbanist, it's unlikely that everyone in your family is an urbanist. So Teddy's wondering, how can you start conversations with people and have these discussions across cultural differences, across differences of opinion? You probably don't have to look very far. You don't have to go out to a coffee shop for that or a public place to do it. But what about you, Phil? I mean, where would you think someone like Teddy can find these kind of conversations and be productive?
Yeah, I have to agree with Marlena. Like, I think she's spot on saying just talk to people that you know, and it's probably one of the biggest things that I do. I mean, talking with my friends back home in Cleveland, you know, they live very different lifestyles than I do, and I think one of the things that I try to do just personally is talk about the positives of a quote unquote urbanist lifestyle. You know, oh yeah, you guys had a really rough commute today, hey? you should think about moving in closer to the city. Like, yeah, you have to sacrifice some space, but, you know, you're going to save time, be able to see your kids more, you know, and so on and so forth. And I think it's really, to me, it's almost a bit of proselytizing. And I think one of the places where urbanists fall down is we tend to be insular. We tend to be in our own bubble, and we go to these meetups full of other urbanists, and we preach to the choir and talk about how great urbanism is and how great we are and how woke we are. But it's really difficult to bring that voice to people who aren't already predisposed to listening to it. So starting with your family and friends is probably one of the best places.
Yeah, that is a really keen insight that Phil just gave us there, because if people aren't predisposed to an urbanist lifestyle, they're going to view a lot of the urbanist lifestyle ideas as sacrifices they would have to make that they don't want to. And one of the really instructive things I think all of us can do is figure out ways that we can craft arguments that understand the values differences, liberals, conservatives, but also beyond that paradigm. Yesterday, Adam Frank, in a different conversation, he's going to be on this show soon talking about his new book about how climate change has probably impacted alien worlds and how we're not alone in the universe with that. But he was saying, frame the argument about climate change this way to people who have been sort of either denialists or not wanting to do something. That it's awesome that we've changed the climate, that human beings have done amazing things and we've accomplished amazing things, but we only now realize, oops, in those accomplishments, we've done something that is negative, but we can unleash this challenge on the business community, on the innovators, and we can do something equally awesome about it going forward, instead of just, you have to give up your car, you've got to do this, you know, the doom and the gloom and the sacrifice. And I think Phil's point there about, you know, understanding people are not going to be predisposed to an urbanist lifestyle is a good one. And then you got to sell it in a way that makes them want it for the values that they have. Does that make sense, Phil?
Absolutely. It's spot on.
Yeah, and so I guess the question we all have to think about is what would do that? So let me grab one more phone call before we get a break, and then we're going to hit one of my favorite subjects that urbanists hate on, which is golf courses. Richard in Rochester next. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi. You know, the panel's been talking about mocking people, shaming, condescending towards their viewpoint. The example was made about avoiding conflicting situations by not engaging with those who we know will disagree with us on many issues, such as supporters of our president. Each of us who does that is just contributing to the polarization of the public over controversial policies. Folks, it's hard work. You have to read the papers that support the opposing viewpoint and find the thread of common ground. I found there's always one, however thin it might be. Build from there to express your viewpoint. By taking this tack, the person you fear will reject your views may actually listen to you rather than getting defensive and block you out as fake news. I'd like to hear some comments on that.
All right, Richard, thank you. I appreciate that. Marlena, I'll start with you.
Yeah. I think that it's honestly the ultimate irony of urbanism, too, is that such a huge component of it is building community, not pushing people away. That's a part of it. When you live, I think of Mr. Rogers, honestly, he was the original spokesperson for learning to live with people that maybe you don't always agree with. And that's just a key part of living in an urban community, is that we might not all be like-minded and we have to live with that. And I think building community and finding those common grounds, I mean, I think that's key for urbanism too, is that, you know, even if we don't agree with people, we can't push them away.
You are free to invoke Mr. Rogers whenever you like on WXX. We're proud of that. Great points there. Jason Partika.
Yeah, definitely. I know when I speak to people and search for, you know, intersections, I always tell people that, you know, if you're ever stuck behind a bus, like in traffic, imagine if that bus wasn't there, there'd probably be 20 cars in front of you instead. And nobody wants to be stuck behind 20 cars at a traffic light when it can just be a simple bus, that kind of thing. If you're trying to get work faster, and let's say you can't give up your car, more cars off the road means you can get to work faster in a car. So supporting things like buses and supporting things like bike lanes will ultimately help you as well.
Okay, David Riley.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a valid point, and I think sometimes we get caught up trying to think about how to make the perfect argument rather than taking a minute to try to understand where other people are coming from. I find, just, you know, in addition to the ideas that Marlena and Jason mentioned, I find that sort of talking about firsthand experience is often more productive than talking in more abstract terms about things like, you know, climate change or how taking a few cars off the road will affect traffic congestion, but, you know, instead talking about my commute and how, you know, living in the city affects my commute, how my life has changed since I used to live in the Boston area and commuted, you know, 45 minutes to an hour and a half to work, depending on
to
traffic.
To go like 3 miles?
Yeah, right. And how much less angry I am, how much less time I spend angry in my car now that I live, you know, much in a much more urban area. You know, talking about your own experiences and how these things have changed your life and hearing other people's experiences and trying to engage on those terms, I find is often more successful way to approach.
But let me twist this, Phil Karras. Cheryl writes to us and says that we're missing one of the important points. She says, I'm offended that you are implying that suburban people who live outside of the city aren't rude. Cheryl's saying they can be rude about urbanism. Phil Karras, what do you think?
Absolutely. And I wanted to call back to something Marlena said earlier about urbanists being, you know, elitist because of their education. But I think one of the things that we overlook, like, way too easily is how elite suburbanites really are in a lot of ways. I mean, think of how many people where it's not a matter of affordability. They could afford to live in the city. They can afford to live in the suburbs. But they choose the suburbs intentionally because they want a 5,000 square foot detached house with three car garage to park their giant SUVs in. If you want to tell me that that's not elitism, I'm not buying that. And I think those are the kinds of people that you find running cyclists off the road or encroaching into crosswalks while pedestrians are trying to cross a busy street. So it absolutely goes both ways. And I would say that they're probably the majority. And so that's one of the things that drives me as an urbanist to not sink to that level. I want to be above that.
Well, after our only break of the hour, we're going to hit the subject that Malcolm Gladwell hit in the first episode of his second season of his Revisionist History podcast, which is about why he thinks we should absolutely be shaming people for playing golf. I think our panel may have some disagreement on this, but that's one idea that urbanists often put in their site is public versus private use and things like that. So we're going to hit that and talk a lot more about tactics of urbanists and bridging divides. You heard Phil Karras. He's on the line with us, the senior planner with TransLink, which is the public transit agency for Metro Vancouver. David Riley is in studio with us, a former newspaper reporter and an urbanist himself. Marlena Zink works for a local engineering firm, and Jason Partika is the chair of the Bus Innovation Group of Reconnect Rochester. We're back in one moment. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, The Washington Post had a recent piece about the way Democrats tend to govern. Democrats campaign on taxing millionaires and the richest Americans. But when they gain power, the Post reports, they're very hesitant to actually follow through. Why is that? It's about money in politics, the political donor class, and more. And we discuss it Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Okay, so on the subject of golf, urbanists often, but this is, I don't want to overgeneralize here, don't like golf courses for the amount of space they use or the exclusivity. They dream of what that space could be used for in other ways. And that's exactly what Malcolm Gladwell did on his podcast. He opened the podcast by saying he hates golf. And he spends about 35 minutes taking a number of different angles, not the least of which is what he calls the American male, white male, executive CEO addiction to golf. He actually looks at numbers of how many rounds of golf and how many hours CEOs spend on a golf course. But he also talks about public use versus private and how he just wants, when he's out jogging in Los Angeles, to be able to hop the fence and jog on a golf course, but he thinks he'd be shot. Let's listen to Malcolm Gladwell.
The typical golf course is 200 acres, give or take. That's a lot of land. You have to landscape it, mow it, drench it in pesticides, keep the sand traps perfect. I read somewhere that when a fancy golf course rebuilds its bunkers, it typically takes about 389 truckloads of sand. 389! Just to keep everything nice and white and fluffy. But at the same time, because golf involves launching a potentially lethal projectile at great speeds across enormous distances, you have to severely limit the number of people on the course at any one time. Typically, a good private course can handle no more than 72 golfers at once. So that's one golfer per 120,833 square feet. Can you imagine if basketball had the same population density as golf? I did the math. If basketball was played according to the geographical requirements of golf, a basketball court would be 30 acres.
That's Malcolm Gladwell just starting his rant on golf that goes for about 35 minutes. But Phil Karras on Twitter the other day, you said that the idea that no one should be able to enjoy sports I don't like is an exceedingly silly thread of urbanism. And you were talking about golf. What do you think of Gladwell's point there?
I think the golf talking point is a bit of a distraction, frankly. Yes, golf courses take up a lot of space. Yes, there is an issue with exclusivity versus inclusivity. But there, if you wanted to take a look at developable land in cities, there are so many other areas we could be targeting that are dominated by detached single-family homes that even a modest increase in density could provide more housing, more amenities, better transit connections. But I'm not sure exactly why we're targeting golf courses rather than the exceedingly privileged few who can afford detached homes in expensive urban environments. I just think it's a bit of a red herring.
All right, David Riley, get him.
I did write a paper in grad school arguing that a golf course in Buffalo should be replaced with housing, but I have my problems with golf courses if for the environmental reasons alone that Malcolm Gladwell touched on, and just water consumption alone is alarming. But you know, that's not to say that there's no there should be no opportunity for anyone anywhere to ever play golf. I guess it's a trade-off and a consideration of how much land should be dedicated for golf. But like Phil, I guess, you know, I worry that this is sort of a rabbit hole that you can easily fall down as an urbanist, that's sort of one of those sort of wedge issues where you will quickly find yourself yelling at someone who really likes to play golf when you might actually have common ground on other things. And of the battles I'd pick as an urbanist, that would be fairly far down my list. I think I'd sooner be, you know, advocating for far better funding for public transit or for zoning that allows denser housing development and things like that.
Jason Partica?
You know, to be honest, I'm not a golfer, so I really don't even give golf that much of a thought when it comes to urbanism. I guess purely from an urbanist standpoint, kind of like in the clip, golf courses would take up a lot of space, so I certainly wouldn't plop one down in the middle of a nice neighborhood and break it up any more than you would put down like a big box star with like 2 acres of parking or anything like that. But again, like on the outside of cities or, you know, on the borders, that kind of thing, there probably could be a place made for the golf courses. If nothing else, golf courses are green spaces. You know,
part of the reason they're so green, as David Riley points out, is the water usage.
Yes.
What do you hate the earth?
The water usage and the pesticides too. So that water seeps back into the water table, all contaminated as well. But, you know, as far as just designing neighborhoods, I'd probably prefer smaller parks to golf courses, but that there's probably a place for them
okay.
in a larger scale.
Marlena.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like Jason, I can't think of the last time I thought about golf. but I think when it comes down to it, first I would want to see how much space golf courses actually take up before having too much of an opinion. But also, I mean, I just really struggle with, as much as I want to get riled up about this, but with telling people what they can and can't enjoy, especially when you could look at it from, say, like a public health standpoint. A lot of people with intense desk jobs are releasing tension in a way that's pretty healthy. So there's so many ways you could come from it. And, you know, getting into what people enjoy doing on their spare time is hard for me to say, like, stop.
This is so weak. You guys were supposed to brawl over this one. Okay, now I take the point that's far down the list of priorities. And even if urbanists maybe don't love golf courses, they're not really thinking much about that because there's so many other more important things that are higher up on the list. Let me go ahead and grab an email from Tim. Tim in Pittsburgh tells us, I know about urbanism. It's great, but you don't have to educate me about it like I'm 5 years old. My family lives in the country because we like the woods, our creek, our vegetable garden, and the peace and quiet. I don't feel the need to advocate or educate people about what we love about the country. We lived in the city and really liked it, but we've changed. Everyone's different, which is a good thing. You don't have to feel the need to change my mind about where I live. I don't need to argue about it. I'm good with the choices my family has made. That's from Tim. Phil Karras, what do you make of that?
A lot to unpack there. I mean, I think he makes a good point, but one of the things I would push back about is that there are a lot of people who would prefer a more urban lifestyle but can't afford it because we don't develop our cities to accommodate that easily. And then there's the other side of it, which is, you know, it's all well and good that you're fine with your own choices, but do you understand how your choices are affecting the overall environment or whatever? I think there's probably... there's more of a case to be made for rural living and kind of living off your own land and whatnot, rather than I think if we're talking teams here, I wouldn't pit urbanists against rural residents as much as I would against suburban and ex-urban kind of lifestyles. But I think it really does come down to understanding, you know, just having a bit more consciousness about, you know, what is your lifestyle? How does your lifestyle affect others?
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. In studio, Marlena, want to add to what Tim said there? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's important to remember that this isn't about blaming individual people necessarily. At least that's not the way I see it. I'm not asking anyone like who's
Tim in Pittsford. Yeah.
I'm not asking Tim in Pittsford to change his life and live in the city. But for people who do live in the city or want to live in the city or just completely don't understand urbanism, I think that's when it becomes important to do the convincing, but especially because right now in Rochester, think of the bus. It's easier for me to drive my car than to take the bus. And so, of course, I'm going to drive my car. So when it comes to, say, you know, breaking down urbanism to somebody like their five-year-old, it's not directed to Tim in Pittsford. That's more directed to leadership who has the power to do something about that and to make it easier for urban people or people who would like to be urban to live an urbanist lifestyle.
So give Tim his space if he wants it, mm-hmm. but let people have more choice and more opportunity if they want to live an urbanist lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jason.
Yeah, I think there's nothing wrong with wanting to live that rural lifestyle. I mean, we're always going to need food. We're always going to need agriculture. So obviously people have to live out in the countryside, that kind of thing. But again, urbanism is about, I guess, increasing people's choices. So not just having to take a car, but a bus or a bike too. So if you want to live in the countryside and work in the countryside, it's fine. I think a big issue is commuting. So if you make a choice to live in like a nice quiet place, but you still want to commute to downtown every day in your own vehicle, well, then we have to set aside land for a parking spot downtown. And that's land that kind of disrupts the flow of the neighborhood or disrupts, you know, creates these empty spaces that just make urbanism impossible. So that I guess that's what I would put on people. It's like, if you really want to live in a nice, quiet place, that's fine, but make sure the people who are choosing to form urbanist communities that you don't impose on that with your lifestyle as well.
So let's close on policy, which David Riley brought up earlier in the hour. Because on that note, everything that our guests are talking about comes back to, are we creating the policies and the opportunities for people to choose this lifestyle more often and more easily, not just from a place of privilege or elitism? And I think everyone agrees, don't be a jerk. So we've established that if urbanism gets a little elitist or snobbish or smug, that's probably not productive. But on the subject of what policy should be pushed for, let's create a short menu here. David Riley.
I mean, I might be borrowing from Jason here, but more robust public transportation, certainly.
Top of the list for you.
Near the top, yeah, certainly. Land use regulations that allow denser development, more mixed use development. Anybody want to jump in?
Okay, Jason.
Yeah, I think land use is going to be really important going forward as we go through, you know, for people who don't know, RTS is in the process of redesigning the bus system. And as we look at how the plan works, it looks great, but now we got to bring everybody in closer. Like, this is probably what we're going to have going forward. And if you want to be able to go down those and connect with bicycles, everybody just would have to live closer together for that to work. And so we just really want to impress on that. If you're going to live closer together, you need workplaces closer to where people live as well. So, you know, not incentivizing places like way out in the outskirts of the county and then saying, hey, why aren't people using buses more? Why aren't people biking more? Well, if everything's 10 miles apart, then it becomes almost impossible to have a good transit system.
Okay. Marlena.
I'm not sure if this is necessarily policy, but I think doing some relationship building in the inner city of Rochester and going back to people who we've put down and told that your lifestyle is bad because you're not living in the suburbs, because your kids don't go to suburban school, because you're taking the bus and biking and walking, and you know, even just going beyond inviting people in the inner city to the conversation, I think drawing on their wisdom and their needs instead of saying, ooh, this is trendy, I want this in my like downtown community, you know, on East Ave, saying, well, you know, there are people who have been doing this for years on Conkey Ave or on Genesee Street, where, you know, where's the equal effort to accommodate these lifestyles that have already been existing for years and have been not only left out of the conversation, but left, well, they have been in the conversation, yeah, but their wisdom has not been brought to the table, mm-hmm, as experts.
Okay, and Phil Karras, 30 seconds.
I think I just want to marry a little bit of what David and Jason both said, and that public transit and land use, I think, have to go hand in hand. Even transit can only be so efficient if you're shuttling people 30 miles between suburbs and downtown, so you have to build up the density along high-frequency transit corridors. And the other thing, I think, is we just have to stop subsidizing auto-dependent uses. Stop building more highways. Stop widening highways. Mm-hmm. Think about congestion charges and bridge tolling, things like that, even as unpopular as those could be.
Phil Karras with a transit agency for Metro Vancouver. Yesterday, our show was all about how Americans know nothing about Canada. You're an American in Canada. You could have been on yesterday. But thanks for coming on today, Phil. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
David Riley, nice to see you as always. Thanks for taking the time to come in.
Same here. Thank you, Evan.
Jason Partika, online. Reconnect Rochester is where, Jason?
ReconnectRochester.org, and find us on Facebook too.
All right. Thanks for coming in. And Marlena Zink, great having you, working for a local engineering firm. Many more conversations to come, we know. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. He's going golfing this afternoon. Probably not. Megan Mack, probably walking or biking. I am going to go out and enjoy the sunshine in an urbanist way. Hope you have a nice afternoon. No shaming, no snark. We'll talk to you tomorrow.